Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're back for a final wrap-up episode of Fargo Season 5. Aaron, I know we got a fair amount of feedback to get through. Do you have any thoughts on the season as a whole before we get to that stuff, or are we just going to give the listeners a say?
I don't think I have much in the additional way of thoughts. I do want to, before we get to everybody, let everybody know that we're currently doing True Detective. We're in between episode 2 and 3 on that. It's airing on HBO Max right now. If you like kind of hard-boiled true crime, Fargo-adjacent content, we're having a lot of fun over there talking about Jodie Foster and company freezing their asses off in the inky blackness of wintertime Alaska. The other thing I want to make you guys aware of is Jim and I are doing, I think, our 7th annual 24-hour movie marathon for charity next weekend, Groundhog Day weekend. That's the February 2nd, starting at noon. That's a Friday till Saturday at noon. We're going to be watching almost every Spider-Man movie in existence and raising money for the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, something that's got a big personal significance to me. If you would like to help us raise charity for a great cause, please join us. You can find out the details, the schedule, where you can watch and where you can donate at groundhog.baldmove.com. Okay, now I think we're ready to talk about Fargo. Jim, you're up first with Zach's email.
Okay, yeah, Zach says, overall I like the characters in this season, but I felt at times like the story or plot struggled to keep up. The Munch wrap-up was weak and felt tacked on. Oh, you're making enemies, Zach, right off the bat. All he needed was food created with love. Eye roll emoji. Can't believe that anyone in that room didn't know they were in mortal danger. I think there's an interesting story to be told about Munch, an immortal who believes he was created from sin, who wanders the world until he can come to grips with how he sees himself and comes to some acceptance with his life and fate. However, the one scene they gave us full of sugary platitudes was not it. As far as... do you want to talk about that first? Because that continues on a different point here.
I think it's, and this is something I guess I didn't pick up on or I don't agree with, the idea that Wayne was oblivious in that scene to the danger.
This is interesting because I saw some takes on it that say he was purposely running interference here. And I could see that, but I also, but my personal opinion is he was kind of oblivious.
Huh. Okay. So we're a house where the bald moves, a house divided. I saw a man who's clearly I don't think he recognized the danger when he's sitting there talking to Munch. So if you want to say some weirdo comes into it, but like, you know, at that point, he's got to be clued into Dot's history. You know, she knows that she's hung out with some weird people. Not all of them are bad, like Gator. I mean, a Gator's kind of dangerous, but he's, you know what I'm saying? So this weird, stinky guy walks in and says he wants to talk to his wife. So Wayne takes him in the living room and kind of keeps him company. I think there's definitely parts where Wayne's eyeballs click. And you can see that he, like, I don't think Scotty is aware of the danger, but like he understands that his family's in some kind of danger. But I think he's doing what he can, you know, like he's Wayne. It's asking Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando, it's like, well, instead of shooting all these in the third act, why don't you, like, get a card table out and do some diplomacy, dude? Why don't you, like, charm them or turn up your Midwest Nights? And he's a Teutonic death machine. Yeah. You can ask him to do all that. Wayne is the opposite of that. And he's doing what he can to give his wife emotional space, to defuse the situation, to... you know, to kind of redirect things towards like a more, I don't know, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I'm drinking the Wayne Kool-Aid, but yeah. So what is, I mean, I guess the case for him being oblivious is just watching the show.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's a plain reading of it, I think, is that, yeah, he's just oblivious. Because, I mean, he's still, you know, you might say he still has brain scramblies. I don't know. He's kind of just back to being Wayne for the most part there. But yeah, Wayne... I don't know. I don't know if I would call Wayne oblivious necessarily in most cases. I think he's... I don't know how to describe Wayne exactly. Wayne is a vibe, I guess.
So there's one email that I had to cut for time who opined that... Because he has a problem with this too. And you know, this was the stand-in for the all Wayne. We got a lot of like... I thought it was I didn't buy that Wayne's so oblivious. And he said one fix would be if you took Wayne and like did everything right, but then at the end, after you have old Munch's beautiful smile, you see the cops come in and arrest him.
And as Dorothy is like, yeah.
Because he has in the background, mm-hmm. as Dorothy's been sparring, the tiger's been sparring with the lion in the den, he's sure. called the cops. And yes, that would could've fix the Wayne oblivious problem, but it would also wreck the entire moral message that Holly's been carefully constructing throughout the whole season. So
totally. And I don't think there's a problem with Wayne being oblivious. Is this a problem if Wayne is just like not seeing the danger here? Because like in my mind, Wayne's first thought is never someone's going to be violent against us or there's any danger here. He wants to be, you know, jovial and yeah. mannered with everyone. It's just not in his envelope of things that could happen, violence. And I know they've been through a lot right now.
That's what I was going to come back to.
Maybe, like, but he's Wayne.
It says something about a man to go through the things that he went through in the last year and then to still, like, you know, like, okay, he's uh-huh. a privileged rich boy living in Minnesota, hasn't faced a lot of adversity, probably hasn't ever been feared for his life. That guy's gone, or he should be. So it's like, I don't know. Do I think that Dodd is like shacked up with a guy with a fifth grade mentality? I guess that says something about Dodd that I don't like. I mean, it's valid okay. reading. I just and the only thing I'm doing is I'm picking up like some tightness around the eyes where uh-huh. and some like, you know, some nervous patter rather than just Midwest nice patter.
And sometimes that's but I could be wrong. Like you can latch onto that and you can say, yeah, this is part of this performance, you know?
Yeah.
No, I think like, to be that lacking in social. Way.
Yeah, just to be that lacking in social awareness and grace. uh-huh. And you could, yeah. I would almost buy it if he was sheltered from the violence of last season. Like, uh-huh. Wayne just can't comprehend that people are this bad. If Dot was successful in completely hermetically sealing her family into a fantasy mm-hmm. and only she was exposed to danger, but like, nah, I don't know.
Yeah, that home invasion changed that. For
I
sure.
I would think so.
I'm with you there. Which is, you know, it doesn't speak to what Zach was talking about here with Ol' Munch, right? Because he thinks the final part with Ol' Munch here was a little too saccharine, a little too, you know, kind of wishing into the wind sort of thing.
I mean, you're not wrong. It's a happily ever after yeah. fairy tale ending. It's a magical thinking ending, but it's also one that he's been carefully constructing since outing Old Munch as a sin eater in like what, the second episode, the third episode. So mm-hmm. If you don't like the ending, then this whole you might say the acting's good and all, but like this whole season must be a failed exercise to you because that's just what he was pitching this season.
Yeah. And in some regard, I agree with Zach. I think, like, if you look at it realistically, what we need is not just, you know, what we need to combat the problems that they're describing here is not simply one person loving another person. If everyone loved everybody else, sure, that would take care of this problem. But to get out of the hole we're in, I think it takes a hell of a lot more than a fresh made biscuit.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
So I see where you're coming from, Zach, on that, certainly. And then he goes on, as far as Miss Lyon being evil, I think the answer is yes. The only good person outside of Dorothy and Wayne is Wit. He acts out of duty and compassion. He sadly attempts to arrest John Hamm instead of extracting vengeance. And, of course, we saw where that led him. Wit leads the rescue team not for glory, but because he wants to ensure that Dorothy is safe and not shot. He is the person the world needs.
It's interesting about, we have some more takes on the whole Wit situation. The whole Mrs. Lyon being evil coming up. It's interesting because I think it dovetails into a meta conversation that's kind of sort of happening on that True Detective podcast we're having where, you know, I've almost completed a full rewatch of season one of True Detective and we're in the middle of season four of True Detective. And at no point, I think, would anyone ever disagree that the male detectives on True Detective are pretty terrible people. They're self-described bad men.
I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. Yeah.
But yet, like, I thought the bit in True Detective as it is like you're introducing these two these two women cops. And I think the show is telling me that they're bad people too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not towering physical manifestations of violence like Woody Harrelson could be in season one. Although Navarro kind of is, I think. They're painting her as a person capable of pretty effective physical violence. But like a lot of like when I interrogate this, a lot of people is like, well, we just, you know, we want to like and root for these women and they can't be bad. And I'm like, but y'all rooted for Russ and Marty, right?
Yeah.
And they were bad. Like, is it not kind of infantilizing women and minorities to be like, oh, they have to be paragons of virtue or we won't know how to feel about them?
Sure.
It's fine when a guy like Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson are being, you know, cheating on their wives and sleeping around and doing drugs and alcohol and making terrible life decisions that are ruining everybody's lives around them and their whole lives and families are disintegrating. Like Don Draper.
Because they're doing good
Tony
police
Soprano.
Work, right? Don Draper's doing great ad work.
Yeah. And he's kind of crushing the things he's crushing, but there's a lot of things being crushed by that as well. And I don't know. I just feel like the inability to say Mrs. Lyon is a lowercase evil or like and there's a lot of meta discussion about like, well, you're saying collection of debt is evil?
No.
I think you can collect debts in an evil manner.
Yes.
I just think sometimes people really screen lock when it comes to women and minorities put in villainous positions to be like they're I don't know why. I suspect that if there's some liberal discomfort in, you know, women, minorities being bad, but they must have good reason. I mean, the Magneto has good reasons.
Sure.
Okay?
He's still evil.
If Magneto is in my town and he's sinking the metal boat that I'm on because he's doing some terrorist attack against humanity, I will go down. Yes, cursing the senators who passed the Anti-Mutant Act. Mm-hmm. And yes, the my fellow men who are making mutants feel like they're dangerous and hunted and wanted and evil and bad. But also fuck Magneto too because he's sinking my boat and killing me. Like,
yeah. Well, everything has to have a bright white line between it right now in our culture. And I don't know how we
except for
get
white
past
men.
That.
We're allowed to be dark.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm just saying that maybe women can be shit bags and we can still root for them. They can still do awesome things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they're going to crack that case.
Anyway, that's me. Also, we're leaving an Indira. And like if we're talking about only two characters being good as Dorothy and Wayne. And Wit, Indira.
Yeah, she's not the paragon of virtue. I think that Wit shows up to be mostly because I don't like her forsaking her duty as a police officer to go work. I understand she has
to make money
very
in the private
reason
sector.
to make money working for the lowercase evil person, right?
Yeah.
She has very good reasons for it. It's not to my taste. Let's say, even though I would be hard pressed not to make the same decision in her situation.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to Corbin, who says, I was wondering if Noah Hawley may have been making a point about generational trauma in this season of Fargo. There are a few examples of generational trauma in this season. Of course, Gator, as obvious trauma passed down by Roy from the constant abuse he committed on his family, and Roy for sure must have experienced the same from his father. The same goes for Karen's likely trauma from Odin. I think Dot's lies to Wayne and Scotty, her attempt to preventing the trauma from passing down to her family. We've talked about, you know, her hermetically sealing her family away from that. I also think it comes back to old Munch. It's entirely possible that Munch isn't actually 500 years old, but was actually describing a family trauma that passed down the line to him. This might also explain why his story doesn't quite make sense. He might not know exactly how his ancestors came to be in America, but he's pieced together a story from what he does know. If the flashback we actually saw was true, that could be Munch's ancestor and sin-eating as a generational trauma for him. With Dot freeing Munch in the final episode, she may have saved him from his own generational trauma while also protecting her family from hers. Yeah, I don't know. I came down that I think this season is either a parable and nothing makes sense, but at the very least, I think Holly was winking at us with Ula Munk's backstory that there is some fabulism going on here. There is some...
Yeah, gotta be.
There is some tall tales. There is a man who is unable or unwilling to deal with his actual past and has constructed this elaborate fantasy backstory for himself.
Yeah, and it works, you know, thematically, because this character is essentially a stand-in for the acceptance of the system. This
right.
You know, like I said in the wrap-up, it's our acceptance of the shit that rolls downhill from the rich to the poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think sometimes it's, I feel like it's hard not to tell a story that includes a generational trauma, because so much, I mean, it's inherent almost in our culture and society that stuff gets passed down, and there's so much of it. It's like, do you have to go out of your way to tell that story, or does it just kind of look like it because you're telling a story that is set in the setting it's in, you know?
Yeah.
To me, that was not something he went out of his way to say about generational trauma. It was more about, yeah, the systems that we've put in place, like the financial and social systems. And how those are affecting our society, not necessarily the generational trauma aspect of it. But I think it's...
Yeah, and that's a good point, too. The fact that institutions aren't really good or evil. Mm-hmm. They just are, and they can be wielded for good or ill. You can imagine a police force that is purely a force of good.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine a police force like a state police, secret police, the Stasi, that mm-hmm. are almost purely a malignant force. They're both police. They're both... enforcing society's laws on a given population, but that can be done in just and unjust, evil and good manners. And, you know, dodging behind institutions, it's like, well, ultimately people make up institutions, and those people get to decide whether those institutions are going to be wielded for good or ill. So, that, like I said, that's how I'm seeing it anyway.
We've got an anonymous emailer. I don't know if this is legal, but I guess we'll make it legal.
There's a lot of personal stuff in here, and they asked me to scrub their personal, so.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Anonymous starts off, says, I didn't realize this entire season was an ultimate wish fulfillment fantasy. Noah Hawley called his shot when he introduced Ole Munch's backstory so early in the season, rather than waiting until the end of the season to drop in a quote-unquote fish NATO. Or supernatural event. That was suspiciously magical early on, too, extremely capable and resilient like a character in a fairy tale. Previous seasons of Fargo were grim fairy tales about wishes unfulfilled and debts unpaid, too, but this season fulfilled wishes and paid debts off. I didn't like this season initially, especially when it became clear Hawley was going to deal with domestic violence and abuse, but the season finale episode pushed every wish fulfillment button in such an unexpected way. It's making me reconsider all five seasons of Fargo as perhaps Noah Hawley's magnum opus, on par with The Wire. He's telling the same story as The Wire, that America is broken at a very fundamental level and systemic level, but in such a monumentally different way. In a different socioeconomic political system, people like Dot wouldn't need wealthy billionaire fairy godmothers. People like Old Munch wouldn't turn to crime, to eating sin, to avoid going hungry. People like Roy Tillman wouldn't thrive as much as they do. People like Deputy Whit Farr wouldn't have to die for literally no good reason. People like Indira wouldn't need to go to work for a wealthy billionaire fairy godmother just to keep her car and her house too, presumably. Every wish is ultimately fulfilled, especially Old Munch, who took his adopted mother's coat and unexpectedly got real warmth and good food from Dot. She fulfilled a wish he didn't even know he had with a biscuit. It's incredible and moving. It's pure fantasy. As a victim and survivor like Dot, I can say that the violence that Dot experienced as a child does not go away. Violence experienced by adults also does not go away. Violence is ugly that way. Dot's miraculous capability and unbelievable self-sufficiency, no one but another victim survivor can possibly know how intense that fantasy is. To be able to fight back and get away, I'm crying as I write this. Did Noah Hawley interview actual survivors? That fantasy hit home. Dot being called daughter by a woman not her mother, and that woman meaning it? As an orphan, yep, check that box too. That wish hit home. The system lining up to help Dot rather than putting her in danger, as the system often does, wish fulfilled. Using the prism of debt, Noah Hawley has literally been following the money since season one to talk about race, class, gender, and money in America. I don't think Noah Hawley is saying he believes the current system will do the right thing. If I follow his thesis from season one to season five, it seems to me he's saying the exact opposite.
David Simon always said that his, I guess, the message from The Wire is that, yes, institutionals will fail you. You can only rely on individuals in your community. You know, direct, quote unquote, direct action. But I don't know. Like, I want to push back on the idea of seeing America as broken, because I feel like that implies, like, oh, it's got to be thrown away, it can't be fixed. Where, you know, it's kind of like this Terry Pratchett book. I think, I can't remember which one it is. One of his Discworld books. The character of Death has this speech where he talks about the way humans see each other. In Judeo-Christian world, we're seen as kind of like fallen angels, right? We had a state of perfection in the Garden of Eden, and we fucked up and we threw it away. The material world tells us, actually, we're rising apes. You know, we come from these tribal bands of animals that beat each other with sticks. And, you know, we filled the earth and we're going to space, and we are actually attaining that angelic perfect status. And I think that's the same thing with institutions, too. You know, America has been around for over 200 years now, 247 years now. And it's been more broken and it's been more functional. And I think if we, you know, I think that's where David Simon's wrong, that if we individually and collectively decide that we're not going to put up with the systems and institutions, we can reform them, we can change them, we can make them better.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, as far as what you're saying about the violence and the wish fulfillment here, and the kind of fairy tale, like the fairy godmother, I think that's a good way to view Lorraine.
Yeah, this is sort of a almost a parable or a grim fairy tale. I think I agree with that. I think, look, I kind of revere The Wire as a very special show. So I have like an initial sort of reflexive withdrawal from the statement that this is on par with The Wire. Mostly because I don't see any real flaws in The Wire. There's maybe a season or two that's not quite as good as the rest, but
season five is a little bit of a letdown.
but it's in a very different way. I see what you're saying. If this connects with you in the way that it seems to connect with you, whether it's simply because you enjoy the subject matter or you have personal experience with it, I could see this being a very important series. And I do think this is certainly Noah Hawley's finest work. I've enjoyed Fargo quite a bit, not just because, you know, of the Home Alone, Big Lebowski style stuff that I thought I was going to get from it, which I've gotten plenty of over the seasons. But also, yeah, those tales that he's telling, those fantasies he's spinning.
The only thing I guess I would push back is it might be because I haven't seen him in a long time, but I don't see a cohesive narrative for like the first two seasons of Fargo, the way like you know, The Wire, each one had like, you know, season one is all about, you know, the crime side of things, and season two is all about the union and the loss of jobs and economic devastation, and like season four is about the education system, season five is about the journalism. The rot. I think season three is about like crossing line, like police crossing lines, maybe. But definitely, like increasingly, yeah, this is Noah Hawley's kind of doodle board for like, you know, talking about the things that he's like worried about or wants to say something about the country. And it seems like, yeah, going forward, that's what's, I don't know about that in season one or two, but season three, four, and now five definitely have those themes.
Yeah, and I think he was searching for it more than David Simon was, right? David Simon set out with an idea to make this particular thing, and it feels like Noah Hawley has found his way sort of, you know, through the Coens and their influences into his own voice here. But he definitely started out with like a Cohen-esque voice.
Yeah, he was making kind of a fun crime.
Yep.
You know, with beautiful imagery and great acting and but also a lot of Cohen Easter eggs and stuff like that. But it's become a lot more sharp and focused. Like he's sharpening his pencil as he goes, you know, each season. Mm-hmm. And we'll see. Like this is the one show that we cover where at the end we're not sure if there'll be more. You know, sometimes we do that because the show might get canceled.
Sure.
But, like, there's always a plan. Like, you know, Foundation Season 2, we expect that there's going to be a Season 3. You know, House of Dragon Season 1, you expect there's going to be a season. It could be canceled, but there's more story to tell. You know, Holly could go wait another 5 years and come up with something else. Or this might be the last Fargo we ever get. It'll be interesting. And like I said, I do wonder if, like, he'll ever go back to just telling another kind of silly Fargo story. Or if they'll all have these, like, greater meanings going forward.
Well, I can't imagine this will be the last idea he has for a season of Fargo, whether or not it gets made. Because I look at the way things are changing so rapidly in our culture. Mm. It's almost certain to... Any thinking person would have ideas sparked by this. So, I don't know whether that gets made or not in the future. I'm interested to see.
I will say that... the ratings this season are down to like 500,000 households.
Doesn't bode well.
I know that for like Fargo led with 1 million people watching it last season. I think the lowest it dipped was 800, and it's been, you know, 500 and below. So it's like, that's the only thing I worry about is like, is FX going to continue to see the value to green lighting these things?
Right.
You had a show that was getting 5-6,000 people, 5-6 million people watching it, and it's been struggling to pull a one share on that. So we'll see.
You're listening to Fargo with Bald Move. We'll be right back.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling.
He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Welcome back to Fargo on Bald Move.
Let's move on to David F. says, it seems like people gave up comparing Gator to Jack Skellington. I didn't see the similarities much at all, but I haven't heard anyone talk about the most obvious similarity between the two. Gator literally has a skull with no eyes. Not sure if this is part of what Holly was getting at, but it felt weird that I didn't hear anyone else talk about something so on the nose. This is where, like, when I go back and I think about Noah Hawley's interviews where he talks about Gator and Jack Skellington and, like, there's a lot of similarities, I'm not buying it. I don't see it at all.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I recently watched this movie for the first time. I'm trying to
What would you say Jack's arc is in that movie?
That's the thing. I don't think he has a huge arc. Like, he comes back roughly to the same place where he was before, kind of. So he's a guy who's bored with Halloween. He discovers, hey, there's another holiday out there. Let me experiment with it. And he does that, and it goes catastrophically wrong, and he has to fix the fuck up he made, and then he's back to being the king of Halloween, except he's now enjoying it. I mean, his arc is he goes from being bored by Halloween to enjoying Halloween through the lens of Christmas.
It's about, like, creative burnout.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, wow, on a movie that took so many years and so much dedication to produce. Whew. I can imagine they were feeling that by the end. But, is Gator experiencing that? Because that's not... I don't really see much of that arc in Gator.
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I was thinking. That I do not... Yeah. Like, I mean, if you... At a really 30,000 feet view, a character making a choice and going down a path that he later regrets or he didn't fully think through and then trying to reverse course. But there it's like, okay, but none of that really happened, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think Gator came to a change of heart because he's like, oh, I see the error of my ways. He literally was blinded and then abandoned by his father. And even then, if he went to the right side of the tunnel and walked out and walked into the open arms of the Boogaloo boys, would he have, I don't know. Like, I just didn't buy the change of heart. He might have a change of heart in prison. I don't know if Dot keeps bringing him her soul saving cookies, but Jack Skellington, I don't see it.
I mean, he had a change of heart. It just wasn't the same kind of change of heart that Skellington had because Skellington looked at his life and said, I've been taking this for granted. That's not what Gator thinks at the end of this.
Yeah. I think it's, I think the Nightmare Before Christmas stuff is just this season of Fargo was kind of a Halloween Christmas crossover the way the Nightmare Before Christmas was. I don't think it's any deeper than that.
I think you're right.
I really don't.
All right, let's move on to Dominic from Levittown. Says, I just finished listening to the finale podcast and I wanted to comment on your thoughts regarding how to podcast a show. Good. I need some outside perspective, man. I'm getting myopic, taking it for granted. You talk about how doing an hour long podcast for every 15 minutes of a movie would be counterproductive. Of course it would. But I don't think that's the issue with doing weekly podcasts. I felt the podcast had become more critical for the sake of criticism. What I mean is I've heard you guys say you've liked 95% of an episode, then take 75% of the podcast complaining about the 5%. We get it. You didn't like X. What's the point of taking so much time on it that the listener doesn't get to hear about the 95% of the episode that you did like? Perhaps I'm mellowing in my old age, solid Gen Xer here, but there's enough complaining in the world without adding it to it on my favorite podcasts. I feel ya. This is a hard nut to crack, and we have actively talked about this because we recognize it in our own podcasts. Like, it's just so much easier it's so much easier to talk about something you don't like. And I think that's true for a couple of reasons. A, you have strong feelings about this thing. And you might have super strong feelings about stuff you like too, but B, you can pull that apart and dissect it and talk about what went wrong and how to make it better. And I think the problem solving part of my brain always gravitates to that. I'm a programmer by nature. I dig into problems and I hold them up and I spin them around and I say, okay, what is the cause of the issue here? And then I try and pull it apart and put it back together in a way that works. And for me, that is kind of the heart of why I talk about the things I don't like more than I talk about the things I do like. And it's a case of, like, there's the saying, like, oh, it's great, no notes. No notes implies I have nothing to add to this. This is great as it is, leave it alone, don't do anything. And so that takes 2 seconds to say, whereas it takes 10 minutes to properly dissect what you think is wrong and what could have been done better.
Yeah, and especially when I think when people are in agreement, it's not just even like good stuff, bad stuff. It's like when people are in agreement and simpatico, it's like you went to see John Wick. John Wick is fucking awesome. Totally, dude. That part where he stabbed a dude in the eye with the pencil. Oh, my God. What about the time where he like shot the guy's knees off and blew the top of his... Oh, fucking awesome. Conversation's done. Mm-hmm. But if you're like in that and you're like, fucking John Wick is sick. Man, I don't like it. What? What about the time with pencil? I just don't know if the pencils can do... Like, you're already double the length of the conversation. But also that could happen, you know, if you both agree that, like, this movie was shit. Oh, my God, it's so stupid. Wasn't it stupid? Yes. I totally agree. Wasn't it stupid? I totally agree. I don't think that thing was stupid. Anytime there's disagreement, and sometimes when I'm sitting here...
It can be even with the filmmaker themselves, right? Because the filmmakers always think they made a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah, so when I'm watching, I am a huge Alan Sepinwall fan. And when I read a couple days in advance, I didn't have screeners for Fargo. When I read a couple days in advance that he thinks this is like a clear return to Fargo, it's so fun and funny and all this and that. And it's like, I'm like hyped to watch it. And I think it lived up to the hype eventually. But Alan watched all 8 episodes before he was able to make his judgment. Yeah. That's where it's like, there's what Jim and I have been saying about like the disagreement, and that takes longer to hash out than when everyone is unified singing praises. Mm-hmm. That's one thing, but it's exacerbated when you might have a few weaker setup, disconnected things up front to build to the superior thing that you want to get to. And it's not fair. Just like, you know, I've read some books that are like super long and boring objectively, but I'm so glad I read them because... the world it put me in, or the conclusion it led me to draw at the end, or the emotional resonance was deeper than, you know, reading a Star Wars book. It's like eating cotton candy, right?
Sure.
But like I said, it would suck that every chapter of that book to be like, oh my God, it's first chapter. Who the fuck are these people? They're just talking. What the hell's the point? Like, and then you get to like chapter 39. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I see. And that's where it's like this Fargo is the intersection of both. I felt like we had beef with the critical community, the fan community, and the showrunner himself and how he is structuring things. And at the end, so it's like if I had not did a single podcast until I finished the finale, I'd have been like, damn, this is a really good, interesting season of Fargo, and let's talk about it. But because I'm having to do week by week... So I don't know what the answer, because I talked to one of my colleagues when we were at a podcast get together once. We were at some kind of con. I can't remember what it was. I'm not going to name names, but I was talking because I know we were both covering the same show. And I was surprised when I was talking to them that, you know, they were a lot more simpatico because we kind of were shitting on the show. And some other people were like, you know, praising it, whatever. And I'm like, wow, I'm kind of really, it's like, I'm surprised, you know, from your coverage that you feel this way. And they're like, well, yeah, I just choose the things to talk about. You know, yeah. I got all this negative stuff I can talk about, but I got all this positive stuff I can talk about. And I'm going to choose to talk about the positive stuff, leave the negative stuff on the table. I don't know how to do that, man. I really don't. Like, I don't have a filter on my mouth my brain. That I don't know how, like, to just ignore that. To me,
yeah,
feels like not having an honest, interesting conversation. Yep. And that I prioritize or I value that much above comedy, I guess, getting along.
I agree.
I want to be understood deeply rather than agreed with superficially.
Sure. Yeah, I can absolutely understand that. I don't like censorship, and I don't want to self-censor, and that's what I feel like I'm doing if I just choose to, if I cherry pick what I talk about, you know?
Yeah.
I'm with you. So that said, I think it is still a problem because from the audience's perspective, I'm 100% here with Dominic. I think it is kind of a bummer when we say we like something and then go on 75% of the podcast about a small fraction of the stuff we don't like.
Yeah, arguably I don't know how to, successful.
I don't know how to honestly change that.
Exactly. Yeah,
if you I know just, how to like, change it, that. But am I going to be betraying myself or feel like I'm betraying myself to change it just to produce a better quote unquote podcast?
And also, like, and I might be full of shit, but like, I think one of the reasons we've built a very strong community is because we've spent like over a decade talking our opinions, good and bad, and like people know and trust us. Like, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's crucial.
I love looking at our stats when we've had like when the rose is falling off the bloom of a show where like you know, like the show that was good and then start having problems and you know, now everyone's talking about the problems. I always see like our finale and like wrap up podcast. I have like 2, 3, 4 times the downloads the rest of the season. And I think it's because we have the reputation for, if you've got a problem with the show, this is the podcast to go to hear it on, to hear an honest airing of it.
You know? Just calling it like it is, not sugarcoating.
All the shows are doing interviews with the producer and have a star lined up for the finale. They're not going to tell you the unvarnished truth. We will. So in the long term, I think it, but like the short term, sometimes we just, we piss people off. Like, I came here because I'm a fan of this show and you guys are shitting on it. What the fuck? I'll find some place that is more, I get it. Yeah, I get it.
And sometimes we're straight up wrong too. I'll throw that
out
there. True. I'm not above saying, sometimes I just get it, I read it wrong.
Or we don't like, some people don't like, there's people that don't like well-cooked steak. Or think it's an immoral thing to
eat.
Now
we got to talk about what well-cooked means.
Exactly. So it's like,
it's so subjective, right? That's the other thing in this business, whatever that means. We're talking about things that are so subjective.
Yeah. See, look, Dominic, if you just come in and say, hey, love the podcast, big fan, we'd have been done in 30 seconds. We've been talking like 10 minutes about this email because there's room to disagree. Tony S. from Arizona says, I got bones to pick with this finale / season. So we spent an entire episode, episode 9, table setting for a firefight that never really happens. It's the Moby Dick of prestige television, but in this one, Holly isn't trying to emphasize the futility of obsession or some other anticlimax that makes this make sense. Why stage a huge showdown and dedicate an entire scene to federal officers bantering and giving Wit a SWAT team and having Roy meet them at the gates, posting a call to arms online to get the strike force to assemble just to lay a big fart in the finale episode. Let's take this first.
Okay, and by big fart, he means not showing this massive showdown that was set up.
Yeah, he wanted to see a whole war, whole ass war, this episode.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I kind of did too. I would have preferred to see that shootout. Is it saying something that we don't see it?
I'm
not picking it up, but certainly it does say something.
Like, one thing that I believe is that you take a fascist authoritarian regime and you leave them to their own devices, you don't have to really defeat them. They'll crumble. Like, in the long term,
eventually,
like what took Roy down was not the FBI agents. I mean, that's who ultimately took him into contact. But who brought him down was a combination of Odin and his current and ex-wife.
Well, and his son. Obsession with them, too, right? It's himself, even.
Yeah, the fact that he puts this call, it's America's, you know, like, you've been buying your ration buckets and your doomsday ammo for me. Now the day's here. Come flock. No one came. Mm-hmm. No one came. I think he's making a point about that being kind of, you know, Lord knows liberals and progressives and whatnot can turn the knives and the firing circles on themselves as well, too. But, like, no one's as good as like, a good old-fashioned authoritarian fascist, you know? Like, that's they just can't get things done. So he might be saying that. I don't know.
What if they threw a secession and no one came?
Right.
So instead, he goes for broke on the wish fulfillment of Roy getting his eternal justice, like essentially a mortal version of hell. And, you know, Munch gets forgiven his sins by Dot.
Yeah.
So Steve DeHare Harrington's redemption arc is that he tattled on his old man. Man, fuck that. Old Munch's box adopted mother is sleeping with the fishes. Gatorade was offering underage girls as bargaining chips 5 screen time minutes ago. Think Holly had a vision of Gator Tillman in his head that we never fully saw translate on screen. And Joe Keery crushed, or is it Keery? Yeah, it's Keery. Crushed his performance. Nothing against him. Vapes vibes in this city of dry sockets. Yeah, I think this might be the weakest part of the season. I really don't know that Holly had quite the fine point to put on Gator's arc.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple tale. It's a tale of a kid who saw his father for who he truly was and decided he'd had enough of it. But maybe too late. I don't know. It's not definitely not the strongest part of the season.
And then in her subtitle, so far, Whitlong said, when Joanna Robinson questioned Noah Hawley about Whitfire's death, he said, this is a true story. It's shown at the beginning of every episode, and in true stories, things are random and sometimes good people die. Interesting perspective on this is a true story conversation y'all have been having over the past couple weeks. To interpret that sentence not as this is a story that is true, but rather this is a story that is true to life, which I actually like better because, like you, I thought that shtick was tired. But two, sometimes people die is a super shitty explanation of why to kill your moral compass.
Yeah, I've said recently, and I can't remember where I said this, but I like my fiction to have a lot of connections in it and everything to be kind of wrapped up in a neat bow. Not necessarily saying you can't have a messy ending like a burn after reading kind of thing. What did we learn? I don't know. But for everything to have a point, if it doesn't have a point, get it out of the script. It doesn't belong there. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, that is a way of saying essentially there was no point to this.
Yeah. I promise this is going somewhere, but it's going to take me like 30 seconds to lay it out. I like this series called Epic Rap Battles of History.
Oh boy. Okay.
And one of my favorites is, George R. R. Martin squaring off against, J.R.R. Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin in this teases Tolkien as saying, like, your stories are boring because we all know how they're going to end by page and age 4. You know, the good guys are going to win, the bad guys are going to die. And Tolkien comes back. It's like, you know what, George? You're right. It is true to life for people to die randomly. But the genre is called fantasy.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's fiction.
And it's, yeah, like, it's not, like, enjoy, it's true to life, but it's, so, like, I think that it's wild for me to hear Noah Hawley on a show that's about, on the face of it, a 500-year-old sin eater. Oh, no. He's 1,000 years old. He rode the Vikings, pre-Columbian, spent hundreds of years with the Native Americans of the Plains. To hear him justify the death of Wilt Farr is like, well, it's a real story. It's got true-to-life elements. Come on.
Yeah.
Here's the other leg. Pull it, dude. So I honestly don't. I don't know why Whitfire died, except for if he didn't, it might be seen as unrealistic that none of the good guys die.
Mm-hmm.
But I if one of the quote unquote good guys die, I felt like they should have like a moral flaw, or they made a mistake. Well, I guess they did make a mistake.
I don't agree with his assessment here. I think Whitfire's death has an obvious point. And it's a point that the bad men, if you don't combat them in the way that's appropriate and necessary, will win, will beat you. Like, individual one-on-one, that's what will happen. He will run up to you, he will stab you with a knife because you are too concerned with preservation of life in order to kill this man who obviously needs to be killed in the moment.
Yeah.
That was the point. Batman, it's not paradox. Just random. It's not like, oh, yeah, sometimes people die in real life. That's not what Noah Hawley is saying at all, or at least That's not what I got out of it. And so for him to say this in an interview is weird to me.
There's also could be he's making a point that, like, I'm not being Pollyanna. Good people are going to have to sacrifice to win a struggle in good versus evil, which is also true. Mm-hmm. You know, millions of people died to bring an end to in the course of and in fighting the last time we had a worldwide expansion of fascism, authoritarianism. That sucks. But it's a, so it's like it could be that, like, yeah, sometimes people are going to have to die to try to make a stand for good in the right way.
Yeah, and I didn't see or hear this interview, so maybe there's a lot more that he goes on about with Whit Farr, and this is just a quote to justify some part of it, but yeah, it's a little weird to me. All right, John G. in Seattle writes in and says, I want to talk about Ol' Munch and that final scene, because if I can be permitted to go back to David Graeber's book again, he does talk about our long traditions of hospitality. There are the ancient types, the ancient traditions of bread and salt, two ancient essential food staples. If you share them with a stranger, you cannot harm one another. This tradition still exists today from the Middle East to Northern Europe. Breaking bread and sharing salt are part of marriage ceremonies, for example. There's an old Arab parable about a thief who is robbing a house and accidentally tastes their salt in the process, thinking it's sugar, and has to put everything he stole back immediately. This is how people living before states existed, with their monopoly of violence way of maintaining order, created customs of trust, especially around shared meals, in order to have a functioning society. These were so effective and powerful, they survive today. So this final scene is very much in the tradition of Catholic communion, but also the much older origins of how sharing meals communally creates the community. When Munch describes living with the people of the plains and that they were his people, he's describing one such stateless community who had that other kind of debt that bound people together rather than reduce them to numbers on a ledger.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting because, like, I wonder if, because I need to read this book, this 5,000 Years of Debt, because, like, it almost seems like he is maybe committing the fallacy of overestimating the old traditions, because, you know, he talks about, like, that these were powerful and effective and they survive today and it creates a functioning society. That's all true, but, like, you know, Game of Thrones famously subverts that bread and salt, and I believe all of the stuff that happens in Game of Thrones are essentially real historical events with the serial numbers filed off.
Sure.
So, like, it's obvious to me that, like, yes, it was a big taboo to violate the bread and the salt, but obviously you could get a giant advantage over someone if you strategically violated those norms here and there. And I think that rich and powerful people have always been strategically violating norms for their benefit, you know? So it's like, yeah, I think maybe we've regressed in a lot of ways of debt, but also these customs that bind us together, I don't think probably are a good solution for a planet 8 billion people. That said,
that's the thing. This works to form communities of that scale, but what happens when the community is too large for anyone to really feel connected to it?
Yeah, and that's the other. It's like if the solution were as easy as just getting in debt to your neighbor, like go and borrow a rake, and then they can borrow, like, we would all be in the perfect society. The problem is, like, we've gone through a lot of rapid change and evolution in human civilization in the last 200 years. It hasn't even been all across the globe. There's still places in the globe that are living like it's 500 years ago. And there, you know, there's some parts of the globe that are sending rockets into space. So it's not experienced everywhere effectively. And also, it's like part of the alienation we're experiencing, that being torn from our neighbors, is because we don't live in little villages that are self-reliant communities.
Yeah.
We live in these giant, you know, either we all live out and kind of still doing that in the rural, but the vast majority of us in this country and most developed countries live in cities where we kind of replace that system wholesale with the system of debt and the system of government reliance and all the stuff, you know. So, like, I don't know how to rebuild the communities, you know, like, and me being a secular atheist, I think that my people have done a lot to destroy those communities without replacing them with anything, you know. We've destroyed the community's churches and everybody going to church on Sunday and talking about issues that they care about and being united in their beliefs and their morals. And we've replaced that with just like, oh, fucking sleep in on Sunday and figure it out yourself.
We replaced it with message boards. forums on the internet. That's what we replaced it with. And that's
where
we
just talk. We talk. There's no debt. There's no services exchanged. It's very easy. Yeah, talk is cheap. Yeah. That's what we're. That's our whole community is based on talk, right? So, yeah. I don't know how to fix that, man. I don't know how to fix the sense of community that's truly the broken thing across the world. Maybe we'll come out the social media stuff, and we just need another 20, 30 years. We can just hold on. We'll get all this figured out.
Maybe.
And we'll adapt and we'll change.
Yeah, if you look at that evolution, it kind of happened in microcosm online. You would, in the early internet, you'd have, you know, your message board or your BBS or whatever, where you go and talk with your community, right? And it was small. There were maybe a couple hundred people in the big forums. And that started ballooning, and now we've got social media where everybody's on it all the time. And so we've lost, again, that community that was forming online. Yeah, how do we... Is there a path forward past that? I don't know. It seems like Holly wants to say we can rebuild that by just returning to some kind of vibe that we had back when it was all communities of a smaller size. I just don't. This is one of the disagreements I guess I have with the end of the season. I just don't see it. Just don't see that being the solution.
Going back to John G's email about the debt book that started off this all, it's like back then those communities had assholes and malcontents and people who were like bucking against the system. But as he pointed out, those people just were murdered. It's like you're doing weird shit in the community. We're just gonna hang you. We're gonna like you're not pulling your weight. You're bitching and moaning, not contributing. So we'll just like drag you outside the city and gates and stone you to death. Boom.
Yeah.
Are we cool with that solution?
No.
Today?
No. Sometimes those people are complaining about real problems. And the
right, probably.
Just like, nah, fuck you. We're killing you.
The village being an asshole, you know? Like, it's like, hey, I just want to be gay over here. I want to practice my own religion over here. Fuck that, witch. You're dying. Like, so it's like, it's return to monkey. As tempting as it always is when traditionalists confront it, it's like not the whole answer because I don't want to go back to where I don't have toothbrushes and fluoride and vaccinations and my kids are dying of polio and, you know, one good drought in my region takes out every town. Like, I don't want to go back to there. So, like, we need new social technology. Our social technology is far being outstripped by our actual technology. And we'll have to figure that out in the 21st century if we're going to get to the Star Trek future that we all want.
Yeah, I mean, if we did go back to that, what would we even podcast about?
Right. Yeah, return to podcast is abandonment of... the return to monkey is the abandonment of podcast.
The guy in the trunk is trying to get out. We'll be right back.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We just put the ads in the wood chipper. Welcome back.
Rick says, Holly faked this all out by setting the series in late 2019. Everyone thought it would end in early 2020 with some kind of COVID tie-in, but then he pulls the rug out by jumping ahead a year and avoiding any COVID references. I love it when a creator defies expectations like that and avoids the easy plot gimmicks. It does raise the question of why no one was wearing masks in that final scene in prison, though, which should have taken place at the height of COVID. You know,
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, that's like something we've specifically called out. And I think we're even talking like as late as like episode 6 or 7 about like, yeah, mm-hmm. I wonder how this is going to, you know, this is set at the precipice of COVID. And there's a lot of pre-season hype about why that might be. But like, maybe it's just because, yeah, he didn't want to deal with COVID. Because clearly you're right. In that prison situation, people should be wearing masks.
Yeah. Yeah, especially the visitor portion of yeah. it, because yeah, I remember end of 2020, and it was not okay, COVID's over, let's go back to normal. It's very much still in COVID territory.
No, we didn't even have the vaccine until what, the spring of 2021 for at high risk groups, right? So
yeah, for normal people to get, sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move over to Andrew in Dallas. Says, when Dot shot Roy, I loved the shot of Roy's bloody smile. It reminded me of Malvo's bloody face before finally getting killed by Gus. Can't help but feeling slightly bummed we didn't get to see any physical comeuppance for Roy in prison. Not saying we need to see him get raped, but at the least, the beginnings of a beatdown. Imagine the end of Lion King if Scar wasn't attacked by the hyenas on screen and Simba only told him it was going to happen eventually. Wouldn't have been satisfying. Overall, love the season, and it was great bounce back from season 4, hoping we never have to leave the Fargo universe and more seasons keep coming.
I think Holly knew he was treading delicate ground with, you know, his professed, you know, and manifest ethics through his series and what he was tacitly encouraging the audience to see as good. And I'm trying to think of like Lorraine's triumphant walk to the drums pays off the same if you get like the Scar where it's like Roy's backing up into a corner and there's three scary dudes with dildos approaching him. Like,
right.
You know, it's like it's already it's already uncomfortably explicit for me. It's like, wow, yes. Roy's a bad dude. But am I, it's like, you know, is this what I want as a viewer? Is this what I want as a... So, I don't know. Yeah. But clearly it did go far enough for a lot of people. Roy's a shitbag, man.
I get it. I get wanted to see Roy get his, but not
yeah, I mean,
like
you could
this.
Argue that he deserves like it, right?
Yeah, but like, absolutely. He deserves some kind of justice. But is that what this is?
And also, I don't know that my politics is about giving everyone what they deserve. You know,
sure.
It's about what you get, what you're entitled to as a human being. And I think even heinous criminals are entitled to humane. Because, like, you know, again, do you believe the prison's there for punishment? Do you believe prison is there for reform? Do you think prison is there to just separate and to just a tragically broken and violent population from a peaceful population? I think two of those things are just and permissible in society, and one of those is just barbaric and caveman shit.
Yep.
So
I feel it.
Greg says, longtime Bald Move listener here. Like many, I was pained by Whitfar's death and think Noah Hawley's decision to kill him was the most thought-provoking part of the finale. It's notable that Farr had three previous standoffs at the Tillman clan this season where he backed down, with Gator in the evidence room, with Roy in the hospital, and with Gator again outside the ranch. Of course, in each of those scenarios, Farr was disadvantaged, either on crutches or outgunned or outmaneuvered. In the final standoff, he had the advantage over Roy and stood his ground, but died. I like Farr's character and do not want to think of him as a coward,
Perhaps rather, it's a commentary on Farr's unwillingness to cross a threshold into violence to put down a destructive force like Roy who doesn't play by the rules. This may demonstrate Farr's fear of doing what is necessary to stop Roy or his underestimation of Roy. We as a society have a similarly difficult time dealing with our real-life Roy Tillmans, hoping and praying our institutions will contain them and or they will ultimately abide by our rules of democracy despite their outrageousness.
Yeah, I agree with this. I think there is a sort of... And I think rightfully so, there is a sort of resistance to sometimes maybe doing what needs to be done. To resist forces that are at odds with peace and harmony. And that's... I don't know what the solution is there. Because it's hard to condone using the tools that we're fighting to fight the tools, you know? Like, if violence is the tool, do we use violence to fight violent people? Well, you might have to. What does that turn the quote-unquote good guys into at that point? It's a tough question, but do I think it's better to sometimes go too far in the direction of like violence to preserve peace, a general peace? Yeah, I probably agree with that.
Reminds me of something. I think it's some sort of activist. I think it was a lady wrote that to effectively function in society, you have to be dangerous on some level. It's to be peaceful, you have to be dangerous.
Okay. Yeah.
Because if you're not dangerous, you're not peaceful, you're harmless.
Mm-hmm.
And only a person's capacity of violence and someone who can be a danger to the system can be danger. Those are only people that can be peaceful. And those are the only people that can get things done in society. Because harmless people at the end, like, oh, the worst they're going to do is tut-tut you. And violent people will just, you know, push their way past them, kill them, whatever. So, like, you know... resonates a lot with me that, like, yes, I want to be a peaceful person, but I also am capable of, you know, like Jesus Christ, peaceful guy, also capable of braiding the whip together and driving out the money changers from his father's house. You know, if Jesus was harmless, he wouldn't have been executed. He wouldn't, you know, So I think that's a good touchstone. And I think, it's weird because it's not that Farr's not dangerous. I mean, he effectively returned violence in the first encounter with Munch, and he didn't necessarily back down to Roy, but he blinked when he shouldn't have at a crucial time. And I don't know, that's kind of heroic, you know?
Yeah, he was too willing to see another way forward was not actually a way forward because of this violent man.
He was committed to seeing his idea of justice done over stopping the bad man. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think there is something heroic and being willing to lay down your life to make a larger point.
Is that what Noah Hawley is getting at here and saying we all need to fight a little bit harder against this stuff? It's great to get online on Twitter and say, we don't condone this. This is awful behavior and it will not stand, man.
Yeah.
And then we sit back and we watch a show like Fargo and don't question whether we should maybe be doing more, maybe be out in the streets protesting, maybe be doing something more active and physical than just saying how much we don't like
neighbors instead of isolating ourselves online and just arguing with people that we either don't see or don't care about, or
yeah, I mean, that's a way to combat
those a lot of time.
Sure, that's a way to combat this festering hatred that's happening. Yeah, but just, you know, taking a more active role and doing what needs to be done as opposed to sort of paying lip service to it, where a lot of people here are paying lip service to it. They're like, they want to say they are this thing, but then are they really? And Whit felt like the guy who was, he was just a little too hesitant to do what needed to be done.
This goes back to, like, our, you know, the conversation with John G. and the debt and the big society versus global, you know, little community versus big society. It's like, we have been accustomed, because we don't live in a medieval village where we just stone people that annoy us, that when we see a person acting crazy or when someone is breaking the social rules, they're violating the fabric of society, what are we told by our parents? Like, just ignore them. Don't give them the satisfaction. Yeah, the
institutions
or call the authorities.
Yep. Yep.
But what happens when we've ignored things for decades and it's just gotten, instead of shrinking away and finding attention and more healthy, what if they just continue to double down and double down and double down? And what if we call the authorities, but the authorities have kind of been co-opted? That's another thing that they never really paid off. The FBI agents accusing their superior mm-hmm. of being, you know, on Roy's side. What happens if those institutions have been co-opted by bad people?
Just so eroded and so dilapidated that they don't hold up against the latest threat, right?
Yeah. Or we're never really designed like, hey, you know, this has always worked on a handshake and a smile. Why codify it into law? Because that's just going to make it rigid and more brittle. I'm always slightly frustrated with shows like this because I'm always, when I'm going into it and it's clear they're making a point about stuff, I'm always like, oh, maybe they have like some new answer. They've got like some wrinkle. And, you know, that's ultimately what's frustrating about Fargo is the same thing as frustrating about The Wire is there isn't an answer. There's just a very good prescriptive description of the problem or description of the problem. But there's not like a prescription. You know, the prescription's ludicrous. The prescription is give the person a magic biscuit.
The prescription is right on. It's just like there's a process by which you have to, like, the employment of that prescription is the problem, right? Like, how are you going to get everybody to love each other when there's this hate echo chamber everywhere?
You have to separate everyone from their echo chamber and individually cook them a biscuit with love.
Right. Right.
Got to get them away from their group, out of their echo chamber.
Completely
that goes
impossible.
For everybody. It goes for everybody too.
That's
everybody's alienated. We have to re-see each other's brothers. That's not a solution that scales above Dot's kitchen table.
Right. And the real solution is so, like, I don't pretend like I have the real solution, but if there is a real solution, it is long term and it is a massive effort by everyone on this planet to fix these problems, and it's not
maybe,
just
maybe
a biscuit.
There is. Maybe he is, because, like, if you go down to the basic, why did Munch turn out the way he turned out? Because he was hungry and he needed food, mm-hmm. and a rich man offered him poisoned food. Wouldn't, you know, like, if that rich man, instead of being like, here's some shit food to eat, and now you're something cursed to my eyes, this guy's dripping with gold and jewels. What if he just gave Munch some beer and biscuits? No sin attached.
Sure.
So, like, I mean, I don't think you can do anything about the Roy Tillmans. I don't think you can do anything about the Gators. But you can do things for, like, the Scotties of the world. You can make sure that they have food when they go to school so they're not hungry in class. You can make sure that their buildings are air-conditioned. You can, you know, if you want to go on a full-blown fucking socialism, you can talk about maybe giving people health care, maybe making sure there's a minimum starvation kind of, like, diet that everyone's entitled to and some kind of minimal form of housing over there. If you could do that, then in a generation or two, you would have much less Roys and mm-hmm. Gators and even Munches running around fucking things up because, you know, that stuff that the Roys of the world talk about, like, you had your heritage stolen from you, you have no one to trust, and there's no one that's got your back, it's a dog eat dog world, you got to be out there cold huddling around the fire bin because that's the way the world's, they'd be like, the fuck are you talking about? Like, even if I was from a broken home, but the state came in, made sure my belly was full and I had a roof over my head and I wasn't sent to some foster family to fuck me up. Like, we can build positive relationships with people and their society, if not their communities. Like, my society has my back. We can scale the village up to a societal global level, but probably won't have as many rich people with gold dripping off their fingers and jewels hanging around their neck and multi-million dollar yachts and things like that. You know, we'll have to make sacrifices, what I'm saying. And by I mean a very small percentage.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what he's pointing out. It's like, yeah, if he just got a fucking Bisquick biscuit cooked with love back in 1500, he would have been mm-hmm. rampaging in 2019. So maybe that's the point he's making. We should be more generous as a society. We should rebuild the village ethic as a society. But yeah, how to do that?
Well, that's
how to
thing,
get everybody
right?
on board with doing that in a democratic society.
Because there's other people, there's the Roy Tillmans that are saying, well, you're going to make people even weaker. The problems we've got are going to be even more severe if just everyone just like gets a basic standard of living for free. Why would anyone work? Why are you working, Roy? You got a big ass ranch. You could have stopped. You know, it's like, why do the billionaires keep working? If it's just sure. to make money, they would have stopped as soon as they got them and their heirs in perpetuity cared for, right? There's other reasons that people work and contribute to society besides fucking money.
Well, that's the thing, contributing to society. I've never understood this kind of, you know, clear-eyed assessment of the way the world is. Well, it's dog-eat-dog, and I got to get mine, and I'm going to screw over whoever I need to because that's the way the world is. Well, are you just interested in preserving the way the world is, or are you interested in making it a better place? Because we can. We have that power. We have the power to change things about this world. And if you're not interested in changing things for the better, then get out of the way of the people who are. We don't need you.
Yeah, I understand why it's attractive, because if you take humans out of the world, it is the way the world is.
Absolutely.
Like, a gazelle is never going to talk their way out of the jaws of a lion, because the lion's got to eat.
Sure,
and
it's a giant entropy machine, and we're all going to die eventually in the heat death of the universe. Why are you doing anything in that case?
But like,
sit down and die.
Sit
down and fucking die, you know?
Yeah, just looking at recent history and how, like, you know, I don't know. It just seems patently obvious that we can make things better. But people want to just go back to nature, red and tooth and claw, and you're never going to beat it. You might be able to cheat entropy for a generation or two, but it's all going to come back when you've made a whole generation of soft men, and they're going to get taken over by the hard men. And it's just, I mean, it's a fucking compelling narrative. And it seems like it's based. It's I think so. Yeah, especially if you've been shit. Well, you. I don't know. I feel like if you've really truly been shit on your whole life and you come from nothing and it's so unfair and so hard that's an appealing, especially if you have gotten to the top of that heap somehow and you have to feel guilty about survive. You didn't survive, or, you know, you won, you know, it's a different way to frame it. And I don't know how you unframe, because it just seems like any honest person that's paid attention to the last few hundred years of human history could see, no, we can make enormous progress. Mm-hmm. We can elevate people out of poverty. We can elevate people by the billions out of ignorance. But it is expensive. It isn't cheap work. But I argue it's cheaper than just this patchwork, duct tape, baling wire thing that we've got going on right now. But a lot of people disagree, which is why we're going through what we're going through. And we just have to get out there and be the dots and wanes we want to see in the world, I guess. I think that's going to do it for Fargo. Once again, I invite you to join us for True Detective. We got a couple of really cool... Well, we got one really good show and one pretty bad show that's coming in February. We got we're putting The Walking Dead to bed. We've said this three times now, Jim. I'm starting to think we're liars.
There's no guarantee this is going to be bad.
It's true. And actually, the trailers look like
big
budget Walking Dead, which is kind of what we've been calling for the whole fucking time.
And if it is bad, that might just be good.
We are our penchant for dragging out and beating the things that we don't like. It turns out people like that about our coverage of The Walking Dead. So we got that. Also, we're probably, I think, going to be looking at... Shogun, which I know if you're a Fargo fan, you must have seen the trailers for it. It's a beloved novel. It was already a beloved miniseries in the 80s. It's like my dad's personal favorite novel. I'm excited to see it. And we're going to be doing that in February as well. So if this is where you get off on Fargo, there's tons of stuff. The Bald Move will be continuing. Please follow us on our social medias at Bald Move everywhere. And then if you have liked our coverage... if you like our slightly skewed, perhaps critical way to look at entertainment, we could use your support. Support.baldmove.com. We are independent creators. We're not affiliated or mobbed up with nobody. It's just me and Jim and our producer, Talitha, in the Midwest, although she is in California, full disclosure. and we're just making it here in the wide world of podcasts. We'd appreciate your support, and you get a lot of cool stuff, ad-free feeds, chief among them, by going to support.baldmove.com. Thanks again for listening to us this whole season. We really appreciate it. Appreciate everyone's feedback and thoughts. And I, for one, hope not Noah Hawley finds a way to get inspiration for season 5 or season 6 of Fargo or anything. Like, I'm kind of down for to see anything that Hawley comes up with. So yeah, hope to see you on maybe The Walking Dead or maybe True Detective or maybe Shogun in the near future. If not, I hope you find your way to Bald Move sometime soon. Until the next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.